sit outside the cage and, you know, watch people.
Well, that's because bearded dragons, they are watchers.
That was such a weird, awkward way she put it.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounded like she was in the movie The Shining when she said it.
Yeah.
But I think she loved the fact that I was such a, you know, big fan of Popeye and that kind of stuff, that she would take my calls. But she lived at that point, she wasn't in Hollywood anymore. She lived on a ranch out in I think it was outside Dallas.
Right.
Or thereabouts. Like a huge falling ranch.
Yeah.
It was definitely post theatrical career of Shelley Duvall.
Yeah, I always thought she was super charming. I always liked her. And I mean, at one point she did the Fairy Tale Theater, I think it was like HBO, or it was Showtime, or
Showtime,
one of those.
Yeah, that was it. She was good with kids' entertainment. That's right. It was Fairy Tale Theater.
Yeah, yeah. And she was. You always seemed very charming, but I think she kind of started to lose her mind a little bit there. And yeah, I mean, you got to see. I guess somebody grabbed her for some kind of movie or two the last couple of years, and I watched a couple of interviews with her. But yeah, Popeye is an interesting movie. It's Robert Altman, right? Popeye, and it's pretty much a musical. I mean, for the most part, and Robin Williams, that was his first real starring role, because I think Garp was right after that, right? Garp was like 82, 81. Yeah,
that's right. And the thing about Popeye was they shot it out in an island near Malta in Greece, and they still had the set up there. And the best part of that movie really isn't necessarily the movie itself, but the looping that Robin Williams did, mm-hmm. you know, in the background, where they just have like 2 hours and it sounded like he was doing something backwards in a Popeye accent.
Yep.
With a lot of a looping. That's kind of like that's the fun stuff of that movie, where it was just weird. Robin Williams being as weird as he wanted it to be with some of the little extras that Robert Altman, you know, throw in there.
Yep, yep. Yeah, that's another sad story. Robin Williams, oh my God. You know, I mean, there's another person who was in a lot of pain, and, you know, I mean, honestly, I can understand why he did what he did, and I would never condone it. But it's like, you get to that point, it's like, you don't want your family to watch you go away, or your fans watch you deteriorate, and you know, another sad case. But what a brilliant man, you know.
Yeah, if you ever saw Insomnia or. You did 1 hour photo when he was by the photo guy.
Oh, yeah. 1 hour photo is great. When he's creepy, he's like sitting on the toilet looking. He's like sitting on the toilet in the people's house, stalking them. Oh, just great. Yeah, there's some good stuff in there. And then toward the end there, that one that he did for Bobcat Goldthwait wasn't bad either. It was like World's Angriest Man or something like that. And, of course, Fisher King, one of my favorites, and Dead Poets Society is good, Vietnam, all of them great. I mean, the guy was brilliant, you know. I mean,
yeah.
I would put him in the beloved category, and he could get away with so much stuff. I mean, he got away with a lot of racy, raunchy stuff, you know, just because it's like, hey, it's Robin Williams, you know. He's just throwing what he can at you, you know. He's just kind of throwing a million jokes at you and seeing what sticks, and one of them's going to make you laugh, you know.
Yeah, he really did have a multicultural hall pass. You know, he did so much work with Billy Crystal and with Whoopi Goldberg, and we all knew that he was a deep down at heart. He was just, you know, a kind man, and he, you know, wanted, you know, he was just a wonderfully brilliant entertainer and a really smart, sharp individual. That's just, it's again, really, you hit on something in terms of like the tragedy of how he just couldn't handle what he was going through, and unfortunately, he went that direction.
Yeah, I mean, just there's only so many people in a lifetime that you'll get to meet, and that's the likes of which we're not going to see again in a while is going to be a Robin Williams. I mean, he's just brilliant, you know. He brought a lot of joy to everybody, and all the stuff he did behind the scenes too, and you know, all the stuff he did overseas, and you know, just really interesting. I mean, I got the pleasure to see him briefly at the Comedy Connection in Boston 1 year, and he was like doing all of his stuff. He's preparing a special, and he came in with that Robin Williams special in like mid-2000s, I think it was, or early 2000s. And
His HBO hour with Mr. Happy. That was a big one. If you were in middle school and he was talking about his wiener for an hour,
right?
Like that was like front row must see TV if you're again seventh grade.
Yeah, You do think of, you know, Mrs. Doubtfire, everybody loved that one, Aladdin. I mean, just so many things. I mean, kids loved them, older people loved them, everybody loved them. Just a shame.
Yeah.
But, yeah, and going back to, like, the musicians, too, like Prince, you know, we talked a little bit about him. I mean, the guy, I remember when he could dance. Like, I mean, he was like a Michael Jackson. He was just as good as him dancing. And what happened was, you know, he messed up his ankles. He messed up his hips. And he couldn't be jumping from stages anymore. It's like all of a sudden, you know, Prince didn't dance anymore from, you know, the last like 10, 15 years. But you watch those earlier ones, it's like, oh, my God. It's like he just did it all, you know?
Almost like Elvis, you know, the same trajectory where, like, the painkillers just weren't working at a certain point for him.
Yeah.
Ricky Calhoun, if you ever have that guy in the show, he really has some wonderful stories about, like, the voting system that he had with his entire group within his productions about bringing in talent or voting off talent. It was very interesting how he conducted his whole infrastructure when it came to the folks that he rubbed elbows with in the entertainment scene. Apollonia was one of those who he essentially got voted off.
Mm-hmm. It's too bad. Yeah, she's still alive. Vanity passed away, but Apollonia, I believe, is still alive, right?
I think so.
Yeah, the Apollonia, the Vanity Six, the Apollonia Six, you know, maybe we need a new six. Need a Chris Earl Six. I can get myself a little lingerie down at the Fredericks of Hollywood, right? So there's the Victoria's Secret, and then if you want to be a real whore, you go to the Fredericks of Hollywood, right? The Victoria's Secret is the nice lingerie. That's like the ladies' lingerie.
Yeah, honestly, I think we're really looking at like the new, like, this is going to be the new Chris Earl, first of all.
Yeah.
And you know, Victoria's Secret is not going to be taking a backseat.
Yeah. You know what? I used to do this one for stand-up. You know what Victoria's Secret is? She's bi. That's it. I know Victoria's Secret. One. She's bi.
It's a good one.
Yeah.
That's a good one.
So I got a couple others here on our list here. First, I got to just mention we are listening to WMFO in Medford, Massachusetts. My name is Chris Earle, and from Pasadena, California, I have Adam Roth on the line with me, and we've known each other for quite some time. We met probably 89, 90, around there at UMass Amherst.
Well, this is the Chris and Adam, that's about 89, 90. It's the Chris and Adam reunion tour here. Hi, Massachusetts. I deeply miss you folks, and miss the food, miss the people, and again, this is a nice little chicken soup for the soul being on the show.
Yeah, it is nice catching up. I actually miss myself. I miss the Chris Earle from 89, 90. You know, he was very cocky, very cocky.
But, not safe for university, Chris Earl. That's right.
So we have a few other items here on the list, and we're also just talking about things off the cuff, about life in general, about music, about movies, about celebrity. I got a Billy Joel a little in the background as we chat away here. How about you staying at the same apartment that Chappelle and Jim Brewer rented? Got a story about that?
It's actually my brother. It was over on Alta Vista. My brother Eli was renting over there with this guy Neil Brennan, who wrote Half Baked with Jim Brewer and Dave Chappelle in that apartment. So I spent a couple of weeks off and on while I was just getting into the swing of the West Coast. But apparently, Chappelle was there in the late '90s, writing up what would be Half Baked, and the last of the trio that was standing in that apartment was this guy, Neil Brennan, who is a really good writer. Did a lot of stuff on Chappelle's show.
Yeah, he co-created Chappelle's show, didn't he? Or he was a writer, head writer on Chappelle's show? Yeah.
Yeah, essentially, Eli took over, like, the spot over in that. I don't know, Alta Vista Drive is the particular location of that apartment. So if you stay there, you probably wind up getting famous. Which you know, seems to be the case, because most of the people between the late '90s there went on and, you know, had lucrative careers in Hollywood.
Yeah, yeah, very nice.
Yeah,
how's Jim Brewer? Jim Brewer is pretty good. I think he's still doing. He was doing some kind of like rock and roll comedy show for a while. It was kind of funny. He had like. Band members with him, like doing like drums and guitar and stuff in the background while he was doing Goat Boy. I think that was
that's,
like...
That's brilliant performance art. I mean, the guy still feels like he's like the same. It's almost like, I don't want to put him in the Carrot Top realm because he's much entirely funnier than Carrot Top, but he's always has a tie-dye t-shirt. You know, it's like Pauly Shore never changed his clothes.
Yeah.
Since the mid-90s, I feel like Brewer is the same kind of guy where he's like, you know, why should I even go out and, you know, get anything from, you know, from Old Navy?
Yeah, I have a feeling that, that Jim Brewer had more to say and he never really got to say it. That was my opinion. I always liked him. I think he had some more stuff in the can that he never got to get out there on SNL or anywhere else, you know. But Half Baked, still a great show.
I don't know.
Yeah, what?
I don't know. Like, you know, even Chappelle needed to take time away from his act.
Yeah,
for,
I mean,
for a decade.
Yeah, Chappelle's just amazing. He's brilliant, and you know, it's interesting because now that he's been back for a while, you know, his the spotlight's off him a little bit more now that everyone is familiar with him again. But when he decided to come back, I mean, that Saturday Night Live that he hosted with Tribe Called Quest was one of the best Saturday Night Lives they had had in you know, the 30 years that we're on at that point. And it was just great to see those specials. And, you know, he ended up creating, you know, those specials on Netflix and that huge comeback and, you know, just great, you know. And I think a lot of times now, you know, you get a little lackadaisical when you don't have as brilliant things to say and you show up a lot more on television and everyone's like, yeah, I'm bored with you.
Totally. And it's interesting is he's very controversial when it comes to, like, the younger set in terms of certain areas of, you know, of people's backgrounds. He tends to rub, he can either, you love, it's kind of in the love him or hate him situation, a lot of dynamics. It used to be just love him or love him, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah.
So it's interesting to see how, you know, he was very irreverent about it, but, you know, he was still Dave.
Yeah. I find it fascinating, too, that he pretty much bought himself a town. Isn't it like a little place in, like, Ohio?
Like Ohio or something like that, right?
Yeah, and pretty much he invited, like, friends and family and stuff, and they all, like, live on the same streets, and they have, like, their own political system. And so I'm like, that's kind of cool, you know? It's kind of interesting. So he created, like, his own island in the center of America.
Right, like Chappelleville, like Dr. Pepper, you know?
Yeah, but, yeah, talk about eccentric. I mean, when you have all that stuff happening, like what happened with Chappelle's show, I mean, it was just crazy, you know? I really find it fascinating, like, you end up doing these shows, I mean, you know, you put, like, a lot of time and heart into it, and if you're filming something and it doesn't even come out for a year or two, you kind of forget about it because you're doing other stuff. And then all of a sudden people like it, and they recognize you. It's just like, what? You know, so that must have really kind of freaked him out, you know, when he became the biggest comic ever. It's like, well, they're expecting something from me. I'm just going to leave. It's like there's nothing that I can do.
Bill Murray did the same thing for about 4 years when he went to Paris.
Yeah.
They were just waiting for, like, that this is going to be, you know, the mid-80s missed Bill Murray. That's like there's one major entertainment gap there. There was no Bill from about 1984 to about 1988.
Yeah. I love Bill Murray, like, too, and he's like an eccentric, too.
When he didn't get to hit in the mid-40s.
Yeah, it's like Bill Murray, he's like a Stanley Kubrick to me, too. It's like, you know what? It's like, show up and do a little bit more work, you know? It's like, everybody misses you. It's like, before it's too late, you know? You got a couple of other things to say, I think, you know? But yeah, he's one of my favorites, too. And like, people have been giving him crap lately, too. Like, I forget who it was. I think it was like Gina Davis or something was saying like Bill Murray like was mean to her on the set. And it's like, give me a break, you know? It's like, come on, get over yourself. You know, it's like all the cancellation and all that crap. It just, it's so annoying to me. It's like anybody can say no. That's all I have to say. It's like, yeah, you're not some innocent waif that just walked into this situation. It's like, just say no and then walk away. You know, it's like people will respect that.
TV off or switch a channel. And now it's like you have to be, indignant, switch the TV off, turn your social channels on and destroy. You know? It's a tough conundrum.
It's just so easy for people to cry victim now and expect everybody to jump on board and attack the other person who may or may not be innocent, but it's just like, oh my God, it's a madhouse right now. And unfortunately, I think a lot of it has to do with those little phones that everybody, you know, has in their hand. And it's amazing to me that people...
Just as you said that, Chris, I put my phone down. Just... You never know. I think something about you here, man.
They can be used for very wise things like research, right? I mean, these are great for finding out things, and then other times, you know, and just like, I'm surprised that so many people have these, you know, computers in their hands and they don't even use them. And it's like, hey, what time do you think the movie is? You know, it's like, oh, look it up on your phone. It's like, why don't you go to Showcase, AMC, and look it up on your phone? Like, really? Can you do that? I'm like, oh, my God. I'm like, who am I? I'm like, am I talking to an idiot right now? You've been around for 50 years. You don't know this? You know?
That's why God invented WebMD, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, you could get lost on WebMD. It's like by the end of the night, you're like, yeah, what do you have? It's like, I have shingles. You know, I got a little croup. Got some Hep C. It's like,
I got COVID on my shingles. I got shingles on my RSV.
It's like, yeah, I went to, go ahead.
I was going to say, like, since we're on the topic of comedians, I can give you that Richard Pryor story. It's a dilly.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I got a prescription for Vicks 44, I was going to say. I got a little prescription for Vicks 44, but it's a 90-day supply, and they're not going to get it to me until next Thursday. That's the other thing that happens now. Richard Pryor. Tell me a story about Richard Pryor.
One of the best stories we had on our floor when I worked in Warner was this woman, Mary Quick was her name. She... long-time admin for the patents guy, Louis Ostrover, who is the patents guy over in Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary was the administrative assistant. She used to work at the Hollywood police station back in the late 60s and early 70s when she started her career.
That's awesome.
So I'm seeing this up because one night, this is back when Pryor was just killing it when it came to comedy,
mm-hmm.
he got picked up. And he was thrown in the drunk tank for a night.
Yep.
This was around 1970, 71, prior to his, you know, lots of prior films. But he got thrown in the drunk tank next to a transvestite prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
And Mary worked the overnight shift, just, you know, working and typing and doing stuff, make processing and filing. And for 8 hours, he said it was some of the funniest material she heard 8 feet away from her, because Richard Pryor was just sitting there with nothing better to do. He starts talking about the Spanish. Like, so now, why do you have the heels with the white spandex? Doesn't that get caught a little bit? How do you get around with that? and the prostitute was giving honest answers about the fashion choices that he, she, they had decided to utilize for that night. And it was like hours and hours of critiquing the costume and talking about, hey, is that a good idea? Maybe you could try red. Like, try red with that. Work out. It was 8 hours of a drunk Richard Pryor with a transvestite prostitute.
No, that's great.
It was just funnier than anything you hear on the album.
You know what's great is sometimes all you have is time, so you got to keep yourself entertained. And I'm sure he never had a problem keeping himself entertained.
Yeah, the entire police department was just pissing their pants in hysterics of what was going on. They don't want to let the guy out after that.
Oh, my God. It's great. Yeah, I knew his daughter, Rain. She had performed at the Edinburgh Comedy Festival, and she was down the street, and she actually had roomed with the other people that were in sketch group with me. She's very, very nice, and everybody was bothering her about Richard Pryor while we were there. He was still alive, but he was on his way out, and unfortunately, he passed away within like the year after we did our show there. But she was super nice, and she looked just like him, except she, you know, was pretty, and she was a girl, and she had big boobs. But she looked just like him. I mean, you could tell. I mean, that's Richard Pryor's kid.
Tree.
Yeah, she did a story. It was called Chicken and Latkes, and it was about Richard Pryor and her mom, who was a go-go dancer. So she talked about, you know, she was, you know, half white and half black, and talked, and also Jewish, and she talked about that in her play. And she actually, I think she, I know she did. She did a she brought the play afterwards from Scotland out to the States. And I know she performed there a couple of times. I haven't talked to her in quite a while, but
what was the name of the one woman show she had? Sounds brilliant.
It was called Chicken.
A very interesting topic, obviously, from her family history.
Yeah, I believe it was called Chicken and Latkes. So that was the name of her book as well. She had a book that she had done. But yeah, really interesting. And she did him, and she would talk like Richard Pryor. It was great. I mean, she did about like 10, 20 minutes of him up front, like when she started her show, and it's like, oh my God, it was just like, close your eyes, it's the guy. You know, she had him down to a T.
Same vocal intonation. Did she live in New York, or is she Chicago, like Richard was, or maybe on the West Coast?
I know she was in New York, but then I believe she moved to the West Coast. I think she lives on the West Coast now. But yeah, it was really fun. It was pretty interesting, being out there and doing shows like every single night for almost 4 weeks. We had one night off, and otherwise we were always jumping on each other's shows too. We did a show. I ended up hosting a show called the Free Beer Show, and it was basically everybody came in, and as soon as you came in the door, as soon as you paid for your ticket, you got a giant beer. and then I invited anybody who was on the show that had a comedy show, or it was a, you know, an actor or anything that just want to come up and do like something. They'd come up and just BS, and it was at midnight every night, and it did pretty good. You know, it was a slow burn. It started slow, but then as soon as people heard about the free beer show, it's like, all right, let's go get some free beer. You know, it's like, it's the price of a ticket.
Like in Europe, Scotland, or Wales, like boom, there it is.
Yeah.
Is the crowd? I think that the Edinburgh crowd is much better than the Jersey crowd.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, it was amazing. The stuff. You know, what was pretty wild was they were very interactive there. So I mean, there would be some comics sitting there, and they'd like literally like sit on people's laps and like go up and wrestle one another. I'm like, what is going on here? And some people would just be in hysterics. And I'm like, this is in the early 2000s, so it's a little different now. But it's like they're basically like harassing and like physically assaulting some of the audience, you know. Mm-hmm. And
that's hashtag Edinburgh Me Too for those of you listening.
Yeah.
Didn't ever go between the years. The year 1080 and 2004. Please let us not. Hashtag Edinburgh Me Too.
We had a sketch comedy show that we had done, and the last like week or so, we decided to not do the sketches, and my buddy decided, well, he's going to do his regular act, but he's going to lose the three sketches that were going on. So the three of us that were left over decided to do our own show, and we called it P45, which was basically an unemployment form that they had in Scotland. So basically we weren't sure what to do. So we came up with this half-ass show where we just kind of got on the stage and we acted like we were at an unemployment office, and anybody that came in to see the show, we brought them right up into the stage and we formed a circle around them and asked, you know, what they did to get fired. And we basically turned it into a little event about unemployment and stuff. And we didn't break the fourth wall. We were basically just played it like, you know, we were unemployed people that just, you know, were having a meeting for other unemployed people. And some people got the joke, and other people were just like, what the hell was that I just saw? But yeah.
Some people are still focused on the free beer. Like, you guys can put anything out there at P45, whatever.
Yep.
If there's a very large beer at my table that I do not have to pay for, hey, I'm a willing participant.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, the free beer was definitely the eye catcher. But that other one was like, all right, we have to do something that's a little odd and try something and see how it is. And that's what's great about that place. I mean, you could come up with like just the oddest comedy idea, or even a play. You know, they had a lot of plays and a lot of musicians there, and it would just be the strangest stuff. Reggie Watts, like, he became huge right afterwards, and he was doing a show there, and it was just great seeing him do all the looping and all that stuff. And you know, it's just amazing, you know, creating all these sounds and loops and, you know, making music on the spot. And at one point during Reggie Watts' show, the fire alarm went off, and he didn't leave the stage. He was just like, he was whining with the fire alarm. And you know, we were wondering, it's like, is there a fire? Should we leave? We had to leave the building. And he's sitting there and he's like wailing at the top of his lungs with the fire alarm as we were walking out. It was great. It was really fun.
Too bad he didn't move the synth out to the parking lot and just, you know, kept the act going. But that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, seeing all the different creative types there. And then, there were other people that are just, you know, bat crazy, you know, which comes.
Yeah, you get like the local loony who's like just, shows up every Monday because that's what they do, and that's how that's their art, and so they get time, and that's the way it works in small clubs.
Yep. And then, I smoked a big cigar with Aidan Quinn of Madonna and Legends of the Fall fame, and what was that? Desperately Seeking Susan.
20th Century Cinematic Greats.
Yep.
Definitely.
Yep. So, Thompson.
It's too bad Madonna didn't fall in the acting footsteps of Mr. Quinn, but you know they all can't be De Niro, right?
That's right. So I got a couple other things in here. Let's talk about. Let's see. Let me go on my list here.
No problem. Can I do one quick plug, if I may?
Yes, and then I want to hear about James Spader. Go ahead.
Oh, Spader. James Spader, yes. Big one turning. His buddy Dom are going to be out at the Riverside at a middle school out there for the World Cubing Association, so hopefully they can defend some titles over there, get in the top 10. But my son's going to, you know, get back at it. And then he's going to be over at USC. They have a cubing competition, so... Lots doing in the QB world, keeps getting more momentum by the week and by the month. So very exciting stuff. Just want to let you guys know.
That is awesome. And good luck to Big 110. I'm proud of him. I'm proud that you got a son that you're active with and you're helping him. And I think that's great. You know, I think nowadays it's tougher to be a young man than it is to be a young lady when you're raising a teenager. And, you know, I think
both have their challenges, but it's a great outlet for young engineering and math minds. It really is. And it gets the kids out. It gets them very social. Like his group, like especially his buddy Dom and other guy Shiloh, they just really, these kids would all be like, you know, number one and number three and number four in any other state except for California.
Sure. Nah, that's awesome. Very cool. Very good. So I'm seeing a story about James Spader. Conversation you had with James Spader when you tempt at CAA.
When you are a floater at CAA, you're exposed to all kinds of, one, celebrities, two, weird work dynamics, but it was a very professional environment over in Beverly Hills. Essentially, I was working for his manager, and Spader calls up just like on a Friday afternoon. He wants to talk to the manager, and he sees a 508 number. He's like, "Yeah, I'm calling you for so and so." I totally forgot the guy's name at this point, but he's like, "Yeah, this is James." And I was saying, "James who?" Spader. So it's definitely Spader. Okay, he tends to be an eccentric guy, and I said, "Oh wow, you're calling us from Massachusetts?" I'm from Newton, Massachusetts originally. How about yourself? He just has a 10-second pause where he goes, "The shore."
The shore.
Didn't want to give it away. He didn't want to tell me.
Yep.
It was a 508 number.
Oh, my God. He was. I thought some of his best stuff was The Office, at the end of The Office, when he got pulled in there to replace Steve Carell. I thought James California was Robert California was probably one of the best characters created for that show. I don't know if you got to see any of that, but I thought it was just great.
No, of course I remember him from like his work. My old roommate Clark used to be, may he rest in peace, Clark, was on the show Blacklist with James Spader for a number of years.
Nice.
So it's nice to see he got a renaissance in his career.
What a great show that is, too. I didn't get to see the later seasons of it, but I watched, like, the first season or two of Blacklist, and I'm like, man, that was just a great show. A lot of fun.
Well, it's hard, thanks, too. Well written, Sky. The director, producer is from Nebraska, I remember. I'm blanking on his name, but very quite a talent as well for, like, where that show went, mm-hmm. where the origins of it came from.
Yeah, and to your point, he is actually a Bostonian. So he actually was born and raised in Boston, James Spader. And I guess he probably still has some family ties here too.
Did you ever see The Music of Chance? That was a great, lesser known movie, but a very interesting, weird, eccentric movie from the early '90s, where he and Manny Patinkin lose a bet of $10,000 they have to make up for by building a stone wall as prisoners in these this eccentric partner, excuse me, these two old weird eccentric guys, and he tries to get off the land multiple times.
What is it called again?
The Music of Chance.
The Music of Chance. All right, he plays Jack Pawsey in The Music of Chance. No, I've never seen that one. I'll have to check that one out. It's James Spader and Mandy Patinkin, who's always great, too. He's always great.
Yeah, great singer as well. Boy, you made it quite a career.
Plus, you got Christopher Penn and M. Emmett Walsh in there, two also great actors that are long gone. But, yeah.
I don't know who's dead. I don't know who's alive. I don't know who's caught. I don't know who's not.
Charles Durning in there and Joel Grey.
Joel Grey.
But yeah,
M. Emmett Walsh.
Remember, he ended up having a good one with Kurt Russell there. M. Emmett Walsh playing the truck driver at was it a '90s movie with Kurt Russell?
Was it Escape from L.A.? Was it? I just remember from Johnson, Maven R. Sounds like a typical bastard.
Yeah, no, it oh. No, I'm confusing M. Emmett Walsh with the other guy, that played a very stern.
Oh, T. Walsh, that's right.
Yeah,
Breakdown. It was Breakdown. That's a tense movie.
Yeah,
very tense movie from 1997 with Kurt Russell. His forerunner breaks down in a small town and just things take a right turn really quickly.
Yeah, I was thinking a Breakdown with Kurt Russell. With that's the one I was thinking of.
J.C. Walsh.
Yeah, he was terrific. And to just bring it all back, M. Emmett Walsh gave Chevy Chase a finger up the hoo-ha in Fletch. That's who M. Emmett Walsh is.
The bar.
Yeah, and he sang Moon River to him. He sang Moon River.
That's right. Use the whole fist there, Doc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we got audio looping for the film 54. Great movie, actually. I enjoyed 54 with Neve Campbell and Ryan Phillip. And another bowling scene.
Yep, we should have segued into this. I'm so sorry we didn't, but I was called in to do some, just because people in New York, they asked me, hey, would you like to just do some crazy loopings and get paid wild amounts of money for 54?
Nice.
And I wound up doing a bunch of, maybe 4 to 5 hours worth of looping work. But there's one scene where, Neve Campbell and Ryan Sleep are kissing in a bowling alley. And in the background, you can hear me saying, I was just riffing, basically saying stuff like, somebody that just go to the bathroom, someone left the bowling ball in there, I'm going to throw it, have to get that extracted from stall number 2. It was about 30 seconds of me just muffled saying that stuff.
That's great. I like both of them too, Ryan Philippe and also Neve Campbell. Neve Campbell is great in all the Scream movies, and Ryan Phillips.
He really was the '90s, and so was Ryan Philippe in a lot of ways.
Yes,
he was in Cruel Intentions as well.
Cruel Intentions is great. 54, Know What You Did Last Summer, and played a small part in Crimson Tide with Denzel and Gene Hackman. Ryan.
Oh yeah, that's a great movie too. Just on the subject of '90s, Webs, the Code Red. Mm-hmm. Hackman gave the order on the sub.
Yes.
And then he tries to get away with it. That was awesome stuff.
That's right. And then Ryan Phillippe also showed up in MacGruber, which was pretty fun too. The SNL sketch movie.
The '80s spoof, right?
Yes.
MacGruber, yeah.
Yeah. But Neve Campbell, I always thought she should have had a little more of a comeback than she's had. She was always great. She was in a television show for a while too, wasn't she?
She was. Look, she was no slow. I'll put it that way. But she was great.
What'd you say? She was no what?
She was no flow. But
no flow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. So
yeah.
We got another story. The Warner Brothers lot department was walking over to an on-the-lot studio store during the opening day of Iron Man the movie. And you actually walked by Jon Favreau, who's the director of Iron Man. I think he wrote part of it, too. Did he write it, too? And he was smoking a huge cigar.
It was one of those weird frozen moments. If you've ever seen someone win the lottery, or this was the closest thing to seeing someone actually win the lottery in real time, because it was the day, it was 2008. My boss and buddy Mike, our department, you go to there's a studio store right by the props department over in the Warner lot where you just get super discount everything, whether it's hats, a t-shirt, crew shirts, DVDs, all that stuff. And who was walking out? And it was almost like in slow motion, right? We were walking by him, and as soon as like John Favreau pops out with his entourage, he lights up a Red Auerbach size cigar and he likes it because he was probably making millions of dollars by the hour in that opening.
Yeah.
And literally, all of us just sort of watched him. It was like doves, you know, he had like doves in slow motion going by. He wasn't even walking, he was floating upward into some millionaire, you know, secret Illuminati of Directors Society. It was a crazy moment, but the happiest man in Southern California at that moment.
That is pretty awesome. Yeah, I loved Iron Man. That came out in 2008, so 15 years plus now, and that started the Marvel juggernaut, of course, of all the movies that came out over the years and the Avengers and all that. I was always a DC man. I always been a big Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman and all those, but I actually really enjoyed the Marvel movies, I think more so because I wasn't so critical of them. And I didn't really know a whole lot about those characters. But Iron Man was just fantastic. And Robert Downey Jr., of course, he ended up becoming, you know, the most marketable guy over the next 15 years, right? I mean, he ended up making a mint from all of those movies, too. So he has Jon Favreau to thank for that, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Having worked at a technological lighting company for 2 years with, you know, the guy who owned it essentially made the Iron Man light, this guy Al DiMeo, that essentially launched a lot of careers, not just for the above-the-line talent, but the behind-the-line, below-the-line talent at the time. But it really, really was one of those things where you could see this guy's life and the whole system out there, or like the genre, was about to be elevated. I used to actually, just on the subject of DC there, Chris, DC was part of the Warner lot, so they had a building where you could go, and if you knew somebody, you just go get free comic books on Wednesday when drop day. You can go in their lobby and just bring a backpack and just get whatever freaking comics and graphic novels you wanted.
It was, oh my God,
it was
awesome.
A very nice perk there.
Yeah. You know what I needed was like a cloud for my comic books, you know, because now they're all just kind of rotting in the cellar. Yeah, it's like I was such a big comic book guy too. It's like, you know, where's the cloud for the comic books so I don't have to, you know, take all these long boxes out. That's one thing about being a comic book fan. It's like most comic book fans, they have, you know, anywhere from like 20 to like 100 long boxes in the cellar of all the comic books they've read over the years. You know.
Well, again, there's that migration to e-comics. One of my children's books was made into an e-published, but they were trying to sort of migrate a lot of the content over to that space.
Right.
It's an interesting need that they were trying to address 10 years back.
Yeah, this is interesting. This is interesting. You mentioned, was it 2010 when you wrote the book? Or was it a little before
that? It was essentially chronicling like my son Ethan's first year and just becoming a parent for both my wife and I. And you know, I was handing the kid off because you're so tired at the time. So I did a book called Checking Up on Daddy. And it was runner-up. It was very close to a national grant from a group in Washington called Fatherhood First. Unfortunately, I lost to a guy in Dallas who apparently got to tour, had like a whole book tour. Lucky at so-and-so, blah, blah, blah. But for a couple of years, you know, it wound up selling 400 or 500 copies just in regular format, and then Warner Brothers took it on for give something like $50,000 or $70,000 worth of R&D, and they made an e-publisher for it and put it on iTunes, which is really nice.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, very, very cool.
Checking Up on Daddy.
You ever think about writing up anything else? And now, is that the only kid's book that you decided to write, or decided not to go?
I had another one called What's an Adventure that was, you know, sort of written and illustrated, but it didn't have the same momentum as Checking Up on Daddy did. And I also had one about motorcycle biker do-gooders called it was called Pod Squad. It was like walruses or hippos with ball chains and mustaches. And I think there was one character I had named Crazy Asian of as well, believe it or not.
From Scooter Trash.
But that yeah, exactly. Yep. He's not around anymore, so he can't sue me. But basically, I sort of put him in the children's book.
Nice. Yeah, that's great. No, that's the fun stuff too. Is you get to be older, and it's like what I love about linking up with people that I haven't seen or talked to in a long time. And I thought this would kind of be fun to do. We don't have to do it, but if you want to, we can. I always find it fascinating when you don't see anybody for years, and then they'll come up with a story or something about yourself that you haven't thought of in 10, 20, or 30 years. And you're like, oh my God, I remember that now. And your brain just clicks something again and brings these memories like flooding back. So I'm gonna do one with you, and you tell me if you remember this or not. I'm sure you're going to.
No, it's totally fine. And again, I'm glad I have my attorney calling in just after as well.
It's not bad.
Safe space.
No, it's not bad. I wouldn't do that to you. It's not bad. It's it is basically. I remember in between when we were doing. When we were doing some sketch writing and we were practicing and stuff, and this is during college, so I mean we were busy, we had classes, everything else going on. I remember that you were drawing, you were doing a drawing. It wasn't painting; it was a drawing. Do you remember what the drawing was that you were doing over the period of 1990?
Okay, this had to have been, was it Crazy Ace or something to that degree,
nope.
Or was it
nope.
Like Michael Jordan?
It was Michael Jordan. You're right. You got it. You got it. I remember you were doing a Michael Jordan drawing, and you were doing a number of different like little sketches, and then you ended up focusing on a drawing, and it took you a little while to do it. And then I remember when we were doing our show, I actually got a picture of like the finished product of you with the Michael Jordan, and you had it like behind the scenes. It was kind of funny. I'm like, that's pretty cool. I got that video somewhere up in my it's on the attic. It's in one of my bedrooms, but there's a I'm gonna have to pull out that video and watch us as young men in our 19s and 20s doing comedy and your Michael Jordan photo there, your Michael Jordan drawing, rather. It's pretty interesting.
That's a great recall. In fact, a few people had wanted that Jordan drawing. It was just straight up pencil, like it was 2H leaded pencil, and I framed it, and he's a little too wide in the picture, but I got him pulled up for a 16-footer. That was one of the best drawings that I ever engaged in. Because, I always tried to do Bird and Irving and some of those other guys, and I always wanted to do sports and illustration. Funny enough you mentioned it, my brother and I, we had an idea for, in 1995, they found the remains of a monkey in the Boston Garden, and we did, after they tore down the old garden, the monkey had escaped from like one of the circuses from maybe the 30s or the 40s. They found the bones of the monkey. So we did the whole thing out like this monkey was up in the rafters helping the Bruins and Celtics to all these championships. It's sort of that leprechaun or spiritual. I illustrated all of them and Eli wrote it. So
that's
but
it.
But Jordan.
Yeah, go ahead.
So no, Jordan was, that was one of the best things I drew in college. And, good memory, dude. I appreciate you for that one. I still have that drawing, actually.
Yeah, it's funny. It's just I remember that you were really passionate about, basketball, Michael Jordan, and I thought, that would be an interesting thing to kind of bring up, like, outside of, like, all the stuff that, went on in college and stuff. I just remember that was one of the things that you were very passionate about, and you were actually, I just found it fascinating that you were taking time in between, like, what we were doing. And that was kind of your downtime that you were working on that too. So you were multitasking with a bunch of different projects, as a lot of creative people like to do. It's like we like to throw a lot of balls up in the air and see what actually sticks.
I think it was for costume design class because I was doing a lot of like design, construction, and costume design, and people were trying to draw. And like the professor was saying, like, this is really good. She started nitpicking it, which is really good. And everybody's just like, man, why are you nitpicking Adam's drawing? That's a really, really good drawing. It's got to be 15 hours worth of work into sort of like a 6-inch by 12-inch space.
Right, right.
Yeah.
That's great. I did one of the things that came back to me just by us chatting, just through text, actually, a few days ago, was the sketch where that we had where I dressed up in a loincloth and you just were behind the scenes and you were doing a documentary for National Geographic or Wild Kingdom or something like that. And I didn't have any words. I was just like in a loincloth and jumping back and forth. one of the oddest sketches we did, but that was a really funny one, I thought. And the Wild Bushman.
Well, you know, there was so much performance. Like, that one was a very well-conceived performance art thing, and people were just, you know, the best thing is watching the audience be totally fish short. They're like, what the hell are these guys doing?
Right.
5 minutes on the week. Not at all. Not in the least. Like, because it gave us one excuse to wear an adult-sized diaper and just to, you know, just pretend you were a bushman out in the wild and you were doing a documentary.
Yeah, I was a bush. I was a bushman of the Serengeti. And at one point, he brushes his testicles as zebras. He makes zebras out of his testicles at one point. And
this was in front of mostly Smith College attendees, which is, you know, my hat's off to them for their patience, what we were doing and how we were doing it and why the hell we were doing it. But again, it's all about the execution, right?
That's true. And there is actual evidence we actually did very well. We actually did very well. For every awkward moment there, there were other moments where it's like, okay, we got him back. And I love this whole thing about being young, where it's like, not only are we hosting, so you got us the gig is what I remember, and you're like, you want to co-host with me? I'm like, sure. Not only did we co-host, but we actually gave ourselves like a 20-minute set too. So we hosted for about 20 minutes, and then our set was, you know, over long. So we did about 50 minutes of this like 2.5-hour show.
we didn't keep the axe coming off and on, which is what you're supposed to do as a host.
Right.
We just pretty much had like 15-minute segments of our bit. It was almost like our HBO comedy day and a half.
Right. And that's what's great about youth, too. It's just like, yeah, don't even think about that. It all comes with experience later on. It's like, yeah, you don't do it that way. But it's very bold, and I love that about being young. It's like you're not afraid of anything, and you usually don't really care what anybody thinks. You just kind of go with it and see what works, you know?
Yeah, yours is definitely sure, because people have a patience for at least some degree of experimentation, right?
Right, yeah. Do you remember what do you remember about me regarding movies or comedy or any of that? Any interesting stories that might bring a flashback into my head?
Okay, well, we used to listen to the prank call tape a lot, like the Jerky Boy and
the Two Bar.
Red Barn Grill. Like, and it's amazing is that, like, not many people know about Red's Bar and Grill, you know, because the guy who did it, who was pranking Red, he went in to confess that it was him. The Red almost shot him.
Right.
You hear that story?
Yeah. Pretty wild. Yeah. And the Two Bar tapes and the prank tapes with the Jerky Boys. Yep. That was around 93 when actually 90 was when the Jerky Boys tapes were coming out on CD.
Right. Yeah. My mother actually stood in line for an autographed CD from Kamal and Johnny B. Like, that was really, she was a very dedicated mother. You know, God bless her, love her a lot. And
yeah.
I remember she waited in line at like either Tower Records and got me that CD autographed. And I was like, go and waste an hour and a half watching the Jerky Boys movie, because there's really no movie. It's sort of like these little mob vignettes, and all of a sudden they go, hey, wait a second, just give me a second, I gotta make this call. And then they just throw in one of the surprise calls.
Right, yeah. Those are fun too. Those are a lot of fun. Yeah. We can't do any of that stuff now. I mean, you know, just that whole idea of picking up the phone. I think nobody picks up a phone anymore. I mean, pretty much it's all done on text, you know. I mean, most people are just doing texts or, you know, a little FaceTime every now and then. Like a lot of the communication in the future is just going to be, you know, doing a TikTok video of yourself dancing, you know, in the bathroom for 20 seconds, and then somebody does an interpretive dance in return for you. You know,
right. Like, me when my teacher doesn't like call me out when I know the answers. .. And there's all like 15 seconds of that.
Yeah.
I'm with you, but you raise a very valid point about connection to people. And back then, you know, in the early 90s, the stuff we were doing in the media, we chose to work with was it. You know, you didn't have to. You weren't hiding behind a phone all the time. You were just out. in the general public.
Yeah, very true. Now I see one other thing here on this list that we had about trauma. I think older trauma 80s movies trailers. He did some voiceovers.
A family friend used to be the head editor of Troma, this guy, Gabe Friedman, who did Poltergeist, actually, as well, Poltergeist fame.
Yep.
He used to call, like, my brothers and I, or some buddies, this other guy, Nick Stevens, who is another Boston, he was like a Boston celebrity. But we would go in and do, like, for $50, this guy, Gabe, would say, hey, do you want to come on in and just do some voiceover stuff? Because we're trying to take these old, crappy, mid-80s, movies, some, you know, Roy Kaufman would buy them and he'd try and package them to other markets, like out, you know, in the Philippines or out in, you know, in Asia, and say, these are Hollywood A-lister actors and we'd like you to buy, you know, some of the distribution for some of these things. And they were like these just horrible, I can send you the link to it, but essentially it was all of us in a rotation, pretending that like these are A-list directors like Lee Candelino, and they were some of the worst. You know, they were like bottom of the barrel. You would have never seen them even on cable. And we had to do all the voiceovers for like these as trailers for movies that were actually coming out and had wide releases. So essentially, you didn't pay $50 for just BSing the most of the APAC territories.
That's great. This is funny. As an aside here, who just pops up on my phone but Vanity from Vanity 6. They have a Playboy for sale from April 1988. So the voices are hearing us, I think. The phone is hearing us, because why would a Playboy ad for Vanity pop up on my phone? I don't get it. In 2024.
Oh, yeah, there's that machine learning about topics.
Yeah.
Or what you're looking and searching for in terms of, user habits.
Yeah. So we talk about Apollonia and Vanity, and then all of a sudden an April 1988 Playboy comes up for sale on the Paisley Five and Dime, which I am a part of out on Facebook Marketplace. They sell all kinds of prints stuff. So very surprising to see the phone pop that up on here, 20 minutes, 30 minutes after we just talked about it. What do you think's the future's going to hold for us, Adam? Is everybody going to be spied on? We're already spied on, is my opinion.
Right, except there's going to be some kind of like payment utility through cryptocurrency that's going to sort of promote the communities to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Where they try to, Chris, you raise a very interesting point. They're trying to do this with Bitcoin Satoshi Vision, where they have a community that will reward for likes and retweets, essentially on a group called Twitch, that they were trying to get going about 3 or 4 years ago. So there will be some kind of like social community that will, you know, much like YouTube has incentivized users and subscribers, there will be like straight payment-to-payments instances of that using certain cryptocurrencies.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not just whistling Apollonia there.
Yeah, you know, I'm gonna talk about the Time next, because I always love Morris Day and the Time. Maybe they'll pull up something for me for Morris Day and the Time later. Maybe I'll get something in there for a show with Morris Day that I can go to
over the weekend. Now and then, that's one of my favorite songs. Yeah.
I saw Morris Day in the Time a couple of years ago. Man, he's still great. Oh, still fantastic. Yeah, you ever want to see Morris Day? Ever get a chance to see him? Go see him. He's great.
Does he still have Jermaine in him?
He doesn't have Jermaine, but he has a new. It's not a butler. What do they call him? The guy that holds up the mirror for him. I forget what they call him. Like a valet. He's like his valet.
Absolutely. He's just like Diddy used to have like 15 of those guys and gals who are doing that for him with umbrellas and things like that. But like Morris Day did it with style.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, one of the best. And at one point, you know, he was doing a little better than Prince, and Prince didn't really like that for a while. So he would turn down the music when Morris Day and the Time would open for him. he would go to the levels and turn them down so people wouldn't get too into him. But
the one thing I loved about I could talk Prince forever and a day, but the one thing I loved about him was he was very supportive in like the rap community. Like he said, like apparently when Run DMC was coming up, like Prince would be walking by Run and Dale Mack, and He said, you know, you guys are going to be big someday, like in 1985.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was essentially prognosticating that these would be the Beatles of rap, and they were.
Yeah. Yeah. They did. Yeah. It was a shame, too, with what happened with DMC there, too. And, you know, he ended up going out pretty early, too. I think he was in his 40s or even late 30s when he passed away.
Yeah, it was some kind of money disagreement, and these guys just came in and did that. It's heartbreaking. It really is.
Yeah, Jim Master J. Eventually, they ended up catching up with the Killer. I think it was like a year or two ago, maybe. Or I might be thinking of West Coast. That might have been it might have been Jam Master J, or I think there was some other breakthrough in a West Coast rapper.
Was it the Tupac or Biggie?
Yeah, it might have been. I think that was big last year, right? Didn't they have some kind of follow up on that where they found him?
I believe so. This is like apparently where they the location where Biggie had passed away was over just near Miracle Mile over in Wilshire, and it's kind of like it's a very nice area. It's right by the Bay of Chocolates and LA County Museum, and it's a very nice area. And then, of course, in the backdrop is this event that happened 2 decades back, that's with Biggie.
Yep.
Yep. But man, I'm trying to think of a really good memory of you. I gotta be honest, like, your love for Public Enemy. We used to listen to a lot of Public Enemy and DC's. That was our thing because they were really, what Public Enemy was doing back then, the fact that the Beastie Boys had provided a vehicle for them to get through, they were disruptive technology a lot like NWA. Again, like cryptocurrency. They were disruptive technology for the mid to late 80s.
Yeah, one of the things about Public Enemy, too, I mean, when we were in college there, I mean, it was 89, 90, this is before Nirvana. So, I mean, this is before grunge really kind of took over in 91, 92. So the biggest thing at that point, you know, 90, 91 was rap. And that was still huge. And, House of Pain was in there and, you know, Ice-T was in there. And then all of a sudden Nirvana came and it kind of changed the whole stage. And you started having... a number of other bands that were more Seattle sound over the air, Pearl Jam.
Yeah, grunge and alternative rock all of a sudden, knocked out rap for a little bit. But ironically, the stuff in the early mid-80s, people were saying in Boston, hey, turn down that disco crap.
Yeah.
It's now really the pop music of our day and age now. In the last 15 years, that's pop music. It isn't rock and roll anymore.
Yeah. It's funny, too. It's like one day, I'm like, I just had one pop up in my head. Do you remember there was a sketcher like, Terminator X, spin the wheel? It was like a Wheel of Fortune sketch.
The bit was, what if Chuck D were hosting Wheel of Fortune? Spin the wheel! That was kind of all. But anytime, everything's all flat, you just say, spin the wheel! That was really
fun. Yeah, I remember that one, too. Terminator X, spin the wheel. Yeah,
that's all you need to say. Yes.
Oh, I got a nice Chuck D story for you. Now that I think of it, I went to go see Public Enemy at the Middle East, and this is going back about 10 years ago now, maybe even longer. And I brought three of my friends with me. And I'm like, I didn't tell them what we were doing. They all thought I was getting married. They thought I was going to ask them to be like, bridesmaids in my wedding or something. And I'm like, no, I'm bringing you to Public Enemy. And they're like, what, really? And I'm like, yeah, we're going to Public Enemy. So I ended up driving them all into the Middle East in Boston here, and we saw Public Enemy, and we got there a little early, and we were getting some beers and just kind of relaxing, having some burgers, and all of a sudden my buddy gets up to use the bathroom, and he like almost knocks this guy out of his chair, and it turns out it was Chuck D, and he was eating a burger, and my buddy Dennis didn't even realize him, and he just kind of like, oh, sorry, and he just kind of went, ugh, and then about 2 or 3 hours later, we were, down cellar, hanging out and listening to Public Enemy. But I'm like, geez, you almost knocked Chuck D right off of his chair, Dennis. And
he brought the noise. Did you say, hey, let him know, Chuck. Let him know that, there's somebody that we care about, Chuck.
Well, it's great because, Dennis comes back and he ended up sitting down with us. And, like, we were all, like, laughing. He's like, what? And he's just like, yeah. He's like, look who you almost knocked over. And Chuck D was just kind of, like, sitting there. And he's just like, hey, waves. And like, all right, we'll see you downstairs. Yeah, but yeah, that was my buddy Dennis knocking Chuck D on his ass. Yeah,
that's impressive, dude. That's impressive. Here's one of the while we're on that thread, I was once standing on a Howard Stern movie, the Howard Stern film, where there's the music awards, and when they were rehearsing in takes, they had some of the celebrities come out to this, it was like the Brooklyn Academy of Music at band, and it was a huge audience where some of the guys like Dee Snider came out, and then like Slave of Slave came on stage just to say hey to the extras, and everybody went crazy. And the next moment, MC Hammer came down, everybody who was standing and screaming sat down quietly and folded their arms.